Hello friends, I'm Asha Nayaswamy, and we've started a second broadcast every day at noon now, which is called Conversations with Asha, Millennials Speak, because in the context of our community here in Palo Alto, we have a very fine, what I call a second tribe, of devotees who qualify according to the definition millennial. And this is Sai Ganesh, who's with me today. And I'm going to just talk to Sai Ganesh, and I hope that you'll find the conversation interesting. So, Sai Ganesh, it seems obvious to me, even though all of us, a lot of us, have Indian names, that our Indian names were given to us by Swami Kriyananda, but I bet you got yours from your mother.
I sure did.
So where were you born, and how did you start life in this incarnation?
I was born and raised in India. I was born in South India. I grew up in a very traditional Indian family. Like most people in this area who look like me, after high school, I went to college to study computer science engineering. Right when I graduated, I think the whole world was entering into a phase of recession, about 12 years ago. So I was planning to come to the US at that point, but because of that, I decided to stay in India and work for a couple of years. And then after things settled down a little bit, I came to the US. I wanted to do my master's. Very soon I found myself in this area, which was now, I think, about 9 years ago for work.
Did your parents, being traditional Indians, support your idea to go so far away from home and come to this country?
Actually, in a way, they did, because it was very common when I went to high school or even in college, because, Indians tend to be very ambitious, and there's just the country is so big, so education and career and growth in those areas was really important, and coming abroad and doing your master's or working, this was a very common, well-trodden path for anybody who was smart and bright.
Smart and bright, which I think I would put you in that category. So were you coming for money?
I think I was actually bored.
You mean just India wasn't challenging enough?
Because I was already working, and I had a really good job working in India. I was living in a city called Pune at that time. And, I was sort of conflicted whether I wanted to go do my master's. By this point, I had already discovered Yogananda. I had read the autobiography of a yogi, and I was already meditating. So my life view was already starting to shift. I wasn't quite sure what I really wanted. Certainly it was not the best or the brightest career, but I just felt at one point like I'm just bored. I think I need something else, something new, something I want to explore. So it was almost like a whim. I was confused for a while and I decided not to, but suddenly one day I woke up and said, I'm going to the US.
Yeah, interesting. And then immediately you were able to do it at that time?
I did have admits from universities already.
I
had just not made up my mind. Even after college I had admits, which I chose not to take, but I had scholarship and admits that were there, and I just decided to come.
When you got to America, did you find it culturally difficult in any way?
Not at all.
Not at all. Interesting.
Because I think my generation, we grew up on American sitcoms and Hollywood movies, and as much as the environment at home was starkly different. I could easily see myself sitting in a coffee shop in New York, with six friends on a couch or something. It was just, so culturally, there was no sense of being alien, because it was what we consumed even when we were 11 or 12.
That's so interesting. One of my Indian friends, he knows much more. I dropped out of culture altogether, all cultures, about the age of 19. So I'm talking to this man who's like 30 now. He knows more about American pop culture than I did. And I was just like astonished. But he said, now, isn't that fascinating? Now let's take it stepping back. Yogananda predicted this East-West blend. Now, isn't this the weirdest way for it to happen?
I sure think so. I'll share something really almost amusing. Where I was with somebody who was one generation younger than me. This was many years ago in India, not even in the last 2 or 3 years. But I had already been in the US for a couple of years by this point. And I was in a restaurant with this person who was probably, I would say, 15 or 14 or whatever at that time. And we were having dosas, the lentil crepes, you have it with potatoes inside, and dippings and all that. And she literally walked up to the person and said, "I'll have it with fries and Coke." And I thought to myself, well, that was the last thing I would have expected to hear. Because that was even different from the times I grew up.
Yeah, exactly.
As much as I was watching all this, I was consuming this entertainment, I've never imagined eating dosa with fries and Coke. But, you know, I guess East and West.
Well, you know, Master said that Western souls are being born in India and Eastern souls are being born in America, so that everybody will feel at home on both sides. Do you feel you're part of that?
I certainly think so. Yeah, right. There's the culture and the couple of generations before me were certainly very different, and the family structure and a lot of what we carry does certainly affect our worldview in some ways.
Right.
But in terms of our ease in interacting and blending,
right,
there is no sense of alienness. I do feel like I'm equally part of India and America because I'm equally home in both places.
Well, I think that's true. That's certainly been my experience of you. I've often remarked that you had a more traditional upbringing, from what you've told me, than many Indians I know, but you are in certain ways less Indian. I mean, in the sense that you really haven't a cultural identity. So let's skip a little bit. So at a certain point, I mean, you'd already found Yogananda before you came to America.
Yes.
But at a certain point, you completely switch track from the American dream. That's what I'm going to call it now, although you might call it the Indian dream. But you've completely switched track to put yourself more into the spiritual path. So tell me how that sort of came about for you.
Yeah, so, you know, I came to this country to do my master's. As much as spirituality was always important for me and I wanted to somehow integrate it into my daily life, it had never crossed my mind. I had not imagined a life for me that was not a bright and successful career in the tech industry or whatever it was. So I did pursue that, and I was fortunate enough to have those opportunities to work in different companies here in the Silicon Valley. And I think this is a question I faced a lot about a year and a half ago when I decided to transition to let go of my full-time position in the tech world and work full-time for Ananda in this ashram setting. I've been asked this question so many times by everyone I meet. How did you do this?
Mm-hmm.
How did you make this transition? And, you know, in a sense, the question itself was not something that I had thought about in that same way, because when I did it and what caused me to do it felt very natural, in a sense, because I had been here for almost 7 or 8 years, and a lot of my life was already consumed, not just in terms of my meditation practice in the inner life, but also in the way I serve and was a part of a community here in Ananda, Palo Alto. So at one point it became clear to me that I didn't need that other job to take time, or I didn't need to do it for money once I was clear that financially I will be able to manage my life with a much, much reduced income. And certainly there was no other part of that job that I was seeking.
Right.
So it almost felt like a very natural transition. It in fact started looking more dramatic to me only when I got that question from a lot of others from the outside wondering, wow, and I would like to do something like that. How do you do that?
Right, how do you do that?
Yeah.
Have you had any... have you had any moments of anxiety about it? I mean, like, I'll just give a simple example. Are your parents, do you feel confident that your parents will be okay? I mean, I know the son's responsibilities and things like that. Does that weigh on your mind?
Well, speaking of my own personal situation, my parents were very unsettled about the transition.
Right.
I think there was, this is how I feel about it, both for myself and also applying it more generally to everybody. I think it's always a balance between common sense and practicality, and also the courage to follow the aspiration that we know is driving us. So I felt like I did it the best I could.
Mm-hmm.
I was sensible and practical in terms of, you know, knowing that I was living a life that I could continue doing with the reduced income, and how I was going to manage and how I was still safe and settled and comfortable, you know, not necessarily throwing, you know, turning my back to the world or being dramatic in that way of walking off from something. But certainly it was a challenge. And it's not been easy for them, because I think it's a little bit more than just the rational process too, because
yes,
it's also a dire decision in terms of choosing a life direction that nobody had foreseen for me.
Right.
So I don't think it's possible to appease it completely.
Right.
But to your other question on, you had one more question there.
About anxiety.
Oh, my own anxiety.
Yeah.
Well, there were always moments where I started to wonder, where was this going?
Where is this going?
It was not so much about losing the career or the stable income, but were, was more the uncertainty of, I don't know where my life is going.
Right, exactly.
And that can be scary
when
one takes a step like this, because I think inherent in such a direction is just not knowing where I'm what I'm going to be or what I'm going to be doing 5 years from now, 6 years
right.
from now.
Right.
Whereas most of the world functions with that view, especially when you're 28, 30, 32,
right.
you're like, oh, 5 years from now, I would have paid 60% of my mortgage.
Yeah.
My child would have, you know, done this. I would have so much in my college fund or whatever that is.
Right.
So letting go of that was, you know, and I have to be honest, sometimes still is
right.
a cause for anxiety, because there is a lot unknown when
right.
you're trying to step into a world like that where you're simply putting your aspirations and intentions and your will first before all the material details, and hoping that they will all fall into place.
They will fall into place. You know, there was a very interesting conversation once at Ananda Village. This was like decades ago, when we were all in our 20s and we had totally dropped out of society and had completely sacrificed our, quote, earning potential, zero, which is what I've done my whole life. And we were having a conversation about a pension plan for Ananda. I mean, like, we were 25, like, but nonetheless, the conversation got started. And one man stood up and said, he said, I don't feel like Ananda owes me anything. He said, I gave my life to God, and if God chooses to have me end my life living homelessly under a bridge, he said, that's his decision, not mine. I don't know if I had the courage to say that, but he really did. So, I mean, what you're partly talking about is, if it doesn't scare you a little, you're not doing enough. Is that fair?
I haven't thought about it that way, but in a sense, yes.
Uh-huh.
I think that is a good indication to know that we are pushing the edge
right.
and making the effort to live our full potential.
Yeah, I
yeah.
think so. There was a man who taught tithing as a mm-hmm. prosperity. And he said, if you're not a little frightened when you write your tithing check, it's not big enough. And that was that thought, because
yeah.
how will we ever know what we're capable mm-hmm. of? You know, let me just, give me a second here to think this through. You know, I read when there was this actually happened to an Indian man in India. When Ananda was in India, Swamiji tried to persuade this young man to do what you've done in mm-hmm. India and join our ashram instead. And he said, my mother would be very disappointed if I did that. And Swami's answer was, sooner or later we have to be, he actually said, sooner or later we have to disappoint our mothers. But he actually amended it to say, sooner or later we have to be prepared to disappoint our mothers. But you know what that represents? Is sooner or later we have to be prepared to reinvent ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that you're sort of like living a creative life? Would that be a way of to describe what you think you're doing with yourself? I mean, do you understand what I mean by
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I do. I think I'm trying to.
Uh-huh.
Because certainly, I think it's a reality that's almost even hard to describe, especially in the US. I wouldn't even say the West.
Uh-huh.
Because when I had the chance to visit the Ananda community in Assisi,
uh-huh.
I saw there were a lot of parallel threads with what Indians would face and the Italians were facing, or people from other parts of Europe were. The American family system is so different
right.
that the individual has a great sense of freedom and independence in how they act in the world
right.
and how their own interests guide their life in a way that perhaps is not common in other cultures at all.
Right.
So it does take a lot of courage to be able to reinvent. And even for me personally, it has certainly been a big karma, and I almost want to say it will continue to be.
Right.
Because striking that balance between knowing how to be appropriate and fit into a cultural and family structure that has always been part of your life
right.
while having the courage to push the edge
right.
and know what and do what you know to be true and follow that heart's call.
Right.
So it's certainly been a challenge,
right.
And I think it will be for almost anybody who's from that kind of a cultural setting, whether India or not.
What kind of, I know that you naturally have a lot of association with the Indian community here in Silicon Valley. Do you find that the dilemmas you're facing are unique to you, or are they shared by the people around you?
They're certainly not unique. I think Indians, like any other demographic or country, obviously there's a whole spectrum of beliefs and kind
right.
of family structures that people might come from,
right.
Whereas some people could be a lot more progressive and others
right.
might not be. So I don't think my dilemmas are unique at all. I think
right.
they are fairly common in terms of what's expected, even things like not just a job, even having a marriage or having children.
Right.
You know, these type of things are not necessarily respected as one's own individual decisions.
Right.
Or even though in my generation likes to think they are, the other generation also thinks that they
right.
do have a very strong say
right.
in having things turn out the way they would like to see. So I think the dilemmas are very, there are a lot of common threads. But also to what we were discussing a few minutes ago, as East and West blend, I think as even parents start migrating and the Indian generation here has lived for 30 years, there's almost everybody just sort of defines themselves. Some people are a little more American, some people have lived here for 30 years
yeah.
but more Indian.
Right.
Some people just landed a year ago, but they're far more culturally progressive
right.
in terms of embracing the American ideals.
You know, I've been fascinated. Because Master speaks of this East-West blend, and when Master talks about it, it's a very big part of what he talks about. India and America uniting, the practicality of America, the spirituality of India. He left his home country, settled in. I mean, it's not a small destiny that's taking place. And one of the things that interests me is friends of mine in India. They're two children, two bright, very bright girls. They were like the 97.5 percentile.
Yeah.
Which is not high enough to get into the best universities in India because of the competition. So both his children had to leave India. One came all the way to Canada and the other only went to Singapore. But what I suddenly see is that it's like circumstances are compelling a whole generation of Indians to leave their country and carry, like, what? What is it that you all are bringing to the West? I mean, what's that shift that's happening?
Yeah.
I mean, we tend to think of Asians as ambitious and achieving.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the point?
I think it's more subtler than that.
Mm-hmm.
I am almost trying to, I'm thinking more about this as you ask the question. You know, when you go in India, I was in India even a few months ago, and, you know, the Uber driver who
uh-huh.
was delivering the food was wearing this large Rudraksha mala. You know, something that is so common to see in India, but something that you would see only in India,
uh-huh.
where you could have a conversation with your cab driver about, you know, God,
yes,
about his deity or his
uh-huh.
guru. And I think that's really what Indians bring to the West in a sense. Whether or not they think of themselves as agnostic, or whether they have a guru, whether they subscribe to the belief systems that their families fed them, that's almost secondary. But they come from a culture where these things are seen differently.
Uh-huh.
And we walk around in the West with that assumption
right.
that I can talk about God, I can talk about right. spiritual beliefs, I can talk about my guru. These things are not taboo. Whereas, you know, in an American society, perhaps 20, 30 years ago, which was completely Western, where religion is such a fundamental private thing,
right.
where it's not okay to be, you know, preaching in a
right.
professional setting, or, you know, the strong line between state and religion,
right.
which all I appreciate as ideal, but they don't need to inform and control our personal lives and how we move in that kind of a strict way.
Right.
My spiritual beliefs are who I am.
Right.
They don't need to be confined to my meditation room that I need to somehow wash it off my skin before I walk on the streets.
Right, that's
very
interesting.
I think that's certainly one of the things that I see coming to this country
right.
with a large influx of Indians, no matter where they go, because, yeah.
No, so let's go to the present moment, March 2020, the end of March here. So if the whole dynamic of our culture begins to shift a little bit, like Where do you see your generation of Asians fitting into that? I call you Asian, I don't know what other words to use, but you know, where do you see, do you feel that there is, do you feel that there's a movement among young Indians to want to be in the West but be more spiritual? I mean, is such a thing possible, or are most of the people who come here still into the let's get rich and have the bright career sort of thing?
When you say Mars, you're not talking necessarily about the pandemic or anything.
I'm talking about the pandemic in the sense of how it might change our culture. If we don't go on, if at the end of this it's not business as usual, is there a group of young Indians who are going to be, like you're saying, we have a job to do here in the West? Do you, I mean, a job to do that's a spiritual job?
I'm not totally sure, because I think Indian or American or whatever, unless people are able to necessarily reach a point in their own life and their own life experiences where this becomes a serious reality that really supersedes self-concern. I think it's still perhaps some years or decades away before there can be a grassroots movement like that where people really realize that all of us have a spiritual work to do, because I think a situation like this, the way I'm at least seeing right now, you know, we're sort of at the edge of the seat watching where all of this goes. The first con of this whole thing is that it pushes people into increased self-concern. What am I going to do? Oh, my bank balance is dropping. My stock value is going down. How am I going to take care of my parents? So there's a little bit of contraction initially. Perhaps when this whole thing sort of rolls about and causes dramatic shifts in people's personal lives, then they might organically come to that realization. But I'm not seeing that to be the first instinctive response.
The first instinctive response. How could you help people make that transition?
I think it's going to take a shift in how people see things. And I think, let me think about this for a second.
What advice would you give if you were, if a young Indian comes to you and says, I'm scared to death, I just don't know which way to turn? I mean, of course, it would have to be a personal answer. It's not theoretical.
But it will be fairly personal. I think the starting point would be for people to realize the need for an inner life. I think even the Indian religion, as much as I was speaking highly about it in terms of how freely you can talk about God, Indians or Americans or whatever culture they belong to, I think people have to come to this realization of having spirituality be inside out. No matter what, what God you worship or what you believe in or what culture you come from, the only way I can deal with the crises, if I were to somehow prepare myself in order to deal with these challenges, I need to do it from inside. I need an inner life. Which is, I think, something that people even in India right now, or even the generation before me or the generation before that, they need to strongly acknowledge and understand. Is that, so my own approach would be to encourage and recommend us, you know, some way of doing that. Meditation practice is, of course, the most obvious beginning, but I think it goes more than that.
How would you define inner life? I mean, I use that phrase a lot too, but I suddenly hear it from you and I think, well, what does he really mean? Yeah. You have to have an inner life. What's an inner life?
I've liked the phrase a lot. I think I've picked it up from you using it.
It's the name of my YouTube channel, I think. No, not too spiritual, something or another. It doesn't matter.
The way I think about it is to be defined by one's own experience more than ideas imposed from the outside. And I always think about that word as being very relevant, especially even in the Indian context, because religion could be approached...
Just for a second. One's ideas are based on experience, not imposed from the outside. Okay, so that's a good beginning. Finished, though.
Yeah. Go on. You know, even religion or spirituality, even a meditation practice can somehow be defined by how it's supposed to look, what I'm supposed to do, what are the rules, and what, you know, a bunch of ideas we read from a book or what somebody tells us. And what I think of when I hear the word inner life is somehow I'm going inside and looking for this myself. I'm taking all this guidance, but the way I make decisions and the way I move forward is by using my experience as my guide. And that, to me, is a way, that's the way I see inner life.
You know, so many people, though, have so much anxiety inside that far from being it a comfort to turn inward, it actually is more unsettling rather than less. Now, what would you say to that? I mean, I'm asking you as a peer, because yeah. both of us do the same kind of work. but how do you answer that when someone says, well, I'm just so nervous, you know, I if I'm alone with my thoughts, they run away from me. And how do you begin?
Yeah, now that you ask the question that way, because I had this conversation with somebody not too long ago,
really?
Perhaps more than one person in the last 1 week, and I honestly did not talk about the inner life because it seemed like it might be a stretch or might not be the most helpful idea right at that moment. And the thing that I had to share with them was to point out to all those examples of people and in different parts of the world, people that they personally knew, not just you know, the 100 Chinese people dying in Wuhan,
right.
but about this person right now who has lost his job,
right.
about this person right now who is stuck in this country because of the travel restriction, about this. So just to expand our perspective to know that everybody is going through a lot of suffering. In the larger picture, whatever it is that seems so impending and so big to me, perhaps it's just a passing phase.
Right.
You know, that was the conversation that I had,
right.
Which is to say, in essence, expand our reality is to look at the world outside and think of what everybody else is going through and somehow become a part of the solution.
Right.
This person is suffering a lot. I feel really bad for this person who has lost his job. How can I help? I'm not just saying financially. So I think that is a very helpful advice for people at this
right.
time, is to think about others, think
right.
about serving, be less caught in that anxiety of being self-absorbed and just
right.
about, you know,
right.
whether you have enough food in the pantry or whatever.
Well, yeah, all those things are real issues. You know, Master wrote a letter about
mm-hmm.
hard times, and he actually said, The solution to hard times is to serve others. It was just a straight. There was no interleaf. It was
yeah.
just when hard times come, serve others.
Mm-hmm.
So that, but serving others then would create an experience,
mm-hmm.
an experience of when my energy is moving outward in concern for others,
mm-hmm.
I don't have as much time to think of myself. Would that be the beginning
yeah.
of an answer?
Yeah, I think so. I have to correct what I said a few minutes ago. I think that comes before the inner life.
Uh-huh.
Because people need to expand. I think it has to come from the heart a little bit more.
Right.
I think the more I can think of others, the less time I'm just concerned about myself, the more potential I have to be happy.
Right.
The more potential I have to be calmer and more comfortable with what's happening.
Right. Well, the Indian worldview,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the traditional Indian worldview, which involves the, you know, the forces of light and darkness, of reincarnation, of many lifetimes, of this long unfoldment, just the ancientness of the culture, in theory, should give a person a perspective. Are cultures too blended now? I mean, for you to really distinctly be able to say something like that now? I mean, we're
Well, I'm seeing, you know, even in my own family, there's been a lot of, in the recent days, there's been a lot of trouble in my family. Just people having severe illnesses and just troubles like
right.
that, not just related to the pandemic. And I grew up in a very traditional family system, and I quite well know that they are all aware of all those ideas. But more than the blending of cultures, it just sort of, you look at that human condition and you see
right.
that philosophy is philosophy and suffering is suffering.
Right.
And that link has to happen from inside out.
Right.
That's
right.
what I don't know if it's the blending of the culture might have a part to play in that, but I think I almost think of it as a human condition.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I've been emphasizing culture in this conversation partly just because
yeah.
our skin tones are different and your life experience is different and your passport is different than mine. Just for the sake of emphasizing differences, but the truth of the matter is the world is just becoming so it doesn't even matter. Actually, one thing I thought about the difference between my tribe and yours, so to speak, is my tribe doesn't care. Your tribe doesn't notice. Whereas I still notice, and then it's not a matter of consequence to me. But you guys have grown up in a world where it doesn't, you don't even know, you don't think of people first in terms
yeah.
of something like that. And I think it's because it doesn't exist as mm-hmm. much anymore. That's the other side of it. You know, we're on the edge of something really interesting. And I mean, do you have any sense that how would I put it, that God brought you here for a reason.
I sure think so. I have a very, very strong sense that my coming to the U.S., my being able to serve full-time in a spiritual community based on Indian teachings in the U.S. has deep sense of purpose and meaning, you know, both for me and for all those around me, because I think my soul needed this too, to be culturally free, to be in that, to be able to stand in those timeless teachings that come from the East and be able to speak of them with authority, but not... Not just to impose a cultural view, but something that's practical, that's something that's applicable. And I think I'm learning a lot in that way too, to be able to live in a setting where culturally things don't look at all the same way as I grew up. The temples don't look this. There are no flowers, there are no colors, there are no big festivals or processions. But all of that is translated into my meditation practice. There's no, you know, every puja, you know, I'm sure you've seen these in India, all these huge offerings, the aarti. I think all of that is now my meditation practice. It's just, I have this deep and strong sense that this is just the next level of deepening myself, of taking all of that outer experience into something that I can... completely experienced through my breath and my meditation. So I mean, that was related to my personal practice, but also with my living in the U.S. I think it is that same thing expressed outwardly in my outer life. So I do think, I do feel a great sense of purpose and meaning.
Thank you. That was wonderful, Sakinesh. Thank you so much for sharing with me. Thank you all for listening.